please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Eric from Lansdale. He's a member of the Big Book Study Solution Group in Doylestown.
All right, Eric.
Hi, my name is Eric. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Eric.
I hope everyone can hear me. It's a little goofy with the echo, but it's all good. And I hope the people on Zoom, hello, welcome. I hope you guys can hear me as well. Like I said, I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is June 11th, 2019. My home group is on Thursday night out in Doylestown. It's a big book study. We go through the big book. We'll read a little bit, and then we'll all sit there and we'll break it down. Keeps me grounded in the solution, and there's a very solid fellowship out there as well. So I really have a deep appreciation for that. And if you're anything like me, when you got to Alcoholics Anonymous, you had to pick your own fellowship. And if you're anything like me, it didn't work out too well. So I have a deep appreciation for home groups and how God has worked in them for me. Sorry, I'm just going to make sure my phone's here so I can see what time it is, because I have a tendency to talk a lot. I'm also thankful to Chelsea, who couldn't be here tonight. She's the one that asked me to come out and speak, and for all the home group members and just AA in general. It's always nice to be at meetings. I have a lot of things in my story, a lot of pain in my story that don't necessarily make me an alcoholic, but, before I go any further with like speaking and getting into this stuff, my hope is always that if you hear something that's a little extreme, you don't utilize that to distance yourself from maybe me or the message of hope and recovery and what it is to be an alcoholic, and that you can look for those common denominators. So I always encourage people to just look for the similarities as far as what it actually means to be an alcoholic. If I don't cover it well enough while I am talking, you can get with me after the meeting. We'll break it down some more. I'll be more than happy to do that. But yeah, like I said, I have a deep appreciation for Alcoholics Anonymous in general. The reason being, there were people meeting in rooms across this country and really at this point in time around the world before I ever got here. And I know what it's like to walk into maybe not that specific door, but the doors or the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and to be absolutely broken and have nowhere else to go, and for people to welcome me with warm arms, and for people to have no idea that God was working in their life and about to drastically change my perceptions on a few things and maybe set me in the right direction. So I love Alcoholics Anonymous. That was not always my story. I have not always been passionate about meetings, this way of life, the 12 steps, talking about a higher power, God, that concept, that idea. That stuff was not attractive to me when I initially was exposed to this program. So it took, like I said, a significant amount of pain. So to go into the back, can you guys hear me okay? I feel like I'm all right, good. So to go into a little backstory about how I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and how I learned to figure all this stuff out or start to interpret this to some degree that allowed things to work for me, right? I did have exposure to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I sat here, and it's like I opened up and like, my name's Eric, I'm an alcoholic. And I was in Alcoholics Anonymous for years saying that and not actually understanding what it was to be an alcoholic. So I would come here, I knew I was supposed to say that when I would share and when someone would talk to me, but I didn't actually understand what it was to be powerless. I didn't actually understand unmanageability. It was easy for me to say, oh, I got a couple of DUIs, I was homeless, my family kicked me out. And I kind of thought that that's, stereotypical alcoholism, or that's what it is to be an alcoholic. Brown paper bag, my wife, my family doesn't want me, I'm under a bridge. I was like, oh, that's an alcoholic. And that is not the case. Today, armed with the facts about myself, comprehending this the way that I do, it provides me the humility that I need to move forward with this program and to open my mind up to some of these ideas and concepts. So like I said, a little backstory. I started drinking when I was in my early teens. Long story short, there were some kids in my neighborhood. They were a little cooler than me. They were a little tougher than me. And I thought, like, these are like the guys. These are like the guys that are like manly men. And there was a place called The Spot in I don't know if anyone's familiar with North Wales. In between Pembroke Middle School and the borough of North Wales, there was a small strip of woods, and we called that the spot. That's where the cool kids hung out, and I was always trying to be cool. So, you know, one day I went back there. I think we had, like, beer or something. It didn't taste that great. And I don't know that I necessarily had that experience with alcohol that very first time. I do know this. When I left the woods that day, I felt cooler. I felt like I belonged. I felt a part of something. And I just felt, like, tougher. And, like, when I went to school the following day, people were going to know, like, he was at the spot with the guys drinking. And I don't know. That was my experience, like, really pursuing alcohol for the first time. I had, like, sipped my mom's wine coolers and things like that at a younger age. And, you know, it's like, can you get us a wine cooler? We'll give you 50 cents. And I would run to the cooler, like, and then, like, give it back to, you know, I'm, like, 8 years old. Who knows? But, this is what I found out happened for me. I get introduced to alcohol, and pretty much an immediate thing that happened for me was I was obsessively thinking about when I could drink again. I remember being in middle school, and I would be at school or just throughout my day, and I'm obsessing over whose parents can we steal alcohol from? Whose parents can we steal alcohol from? And I did have these experiences. Like they say, men and women drink essentially because we like the effects produced by alcohol, right? My experience was alcohol, that it worked so well that I never wanted to stop drinking it. Because there's like a slang term, like I'm on point or I'm on. I just felt great. I felt alive. I felt like I could dance better, sing, whatever, like talk to people. I was funnier. I felt like I could look the world in the eye and be at peace. And I enjoyed it. Alcohol worked. It was great. It was a higher power for a very, 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 very long time. And it worked. And that's why I went back to it. I didn't realize that at the time. Like I might have realized it was working, but I didn't understand what was happening in my life. I was just a young kid who really enjoyed drinking, and I couldn't understand why other people didn't enjoy it as much as I do. And I grew up in a town, like, there was a bunch of kids that were, like, close to my age, and we all drank. We all drank a significant amount. But it was clear, and it's even more clear looking back on it now, it was definitely doing something for me that it wasn't doing for them. Because the way that I was going about pursuing it was obsessive, obsessive, obsessive. And, you know, so this carried on. You know, I had I think it was like New Year's 2000. I think I was in like ninth grade. And I'm hugging a toilet, orange Smirnoff or something like that. And I remember thinking, like, I'm never, ever, ever drinking again. Like, this is an absolute nightmare. I could never fathom doing this. And I guarantee I was drunk within like a week of that. I jogged home or something, like 6-7-8 miles, I don't know. And then it's like, I'm never doing this again. I hate alcohol. I'm never doing this. Spinning. And, you know, and these are like the early stages of understanding what it is to be powerless. And I'm never doing that again. And then you come back to it without any hesitancy whatsoever. Middle school, I kind of just kind of floated by. I think that my parents probably knew I was drinking. It was pretty evident that I was hanging around the kids I should not hang around with. My mom, you know, I'll put it like this. I'll mention this, and then I'll also mention a few other times, like, briefly. But, like, the same people that introduced me to alcohol were doing other things. And I thought to myself, if alcohol works this well, and if they have these other things, then, like, maybe these things will work well, too. I went about as far as you can go down that path as well. And I'll just leave it at that. You can plug in your story, where necessary. But I went far and wide down that path too. And my mom has, she had the horrible experience of walking into her son's room and seeing all of this stuff. You know, I'll leave it at that. You know, she walks in, I have like an array of things. She's like, what are you doing? I'm like, get out of my room. So, I started getting kicked out of my parents' house when I was like 15 or 16. Doesn't make me an alcoholic by any means. But the unmanageability while someone is actively drinking is probably one of the first things that sticks out. So we talk about powerlessness. When I started drinking, I did not want to stop drinking. Didn't make sense to me to stop drinking. Even if I wanted to stop drinking, I wouldn't stop drinking. When I did stop drinking, I was obsessive, over drinking, and that would go as well. You know, so it's like, okay, I'm drinking, I can't stop, I'm doing dumb things, I'm smashing my head through the walls of my, friends' houses, they're like, Eric, you should probably not drink as much. I was like, you're a lightweight. Catch up. And I had like these embarrassing moments all throughout middle school. And this stuff happened very fast for me. And it's like, okay, that's powerlessness. And then there's also the mental, like sick peculiar twist. And the twisted, I forget what the correct terminology is, but like the obsession of the mind that takes place when I don't have alcohol, where it's just spinning and spinning and spinning in my brain until I get some more. So that powerlessness was happening for me. But I wouldn't really admit that. I wouldn't really like confess to that or anything. But the unmanageability while I'm actively drinking was very, very ugly. I knew that there were things that were occurring as a result of my inability to control the amount that I was drinking. And those things stuck out drastically to not only me, but my family members and friends. And I began getting 302'd. I suffered from depression at a young age. I always include this in my story. I got 302'd. I was at Building 50. It's a beautiful place, especially this time of year. Center Hall, I don't know if you guys are familiar with this, but that's like where you go when you're like extra crazy. There's a thing called one-on-one. So it's like this one gets strapped to this part of the bed, this one gets strapped to this part of the bed. And I remember I would get into that place and I'm just obsessively thinking like, I have to get back to it. I have to get back to drinking. And you would think something like that would be a wake-up call. A lot of my friends in middle school, and then it gets into like the early years of high school, are like, hey man, like, don't you think maybe you should? And I'm like, that's so ridiculous. How could I? Like, it doesn't make sense. What, stop drinking or stop like doing what I'm doing? And you know, that was my childhood, or I should say like my like teenage years, you know, like middle school into high school, and it really just took off for me. I started to lose friendships and relationships, not because people like didn't love me. It was actually just so difficult to love me, that people had to distance themselves from me. I had a good friend of mine in high school. I remember we were coming home from football practice one time and he's like, he just breaks down crying. He's like, yo man, like, he's like, there's something really wrong with you. Like, there's something wrong with you. Like, you know, you have to like make a change. And he's like, and I just know that like there's nothing I can do to get through to you. And he's like, and like, I love you. You're my closest friend, but I can't do anything. Like I don't know if he understood what an alcoholic was or what I was confronted with, but he knew there was, you know, probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. Like, he was able to see that in me, and it crushed him. So he just had to distance himself. And there was a lot of close friends and loving, loving, loving people in my life that was my experience with. The flip side to that coin was this. People were encouraging me not to drink, and drinking was my solution. So when people would encourage me to not do that, I just had to distance myself from them. You cannot take away my solution. This works for me. Men and women drink essentially because they like the effects produced by alcohol. And that was my experience. It's absolutely unfathomable. Sorry, my speech is off. I cannot comprehend not having a drink. It does not make any sense to me in any way, shape, or form at this period in my life. So as time goes on, you know, high school is coming to an end. I'm causing significant damage. I've lived at like several of my friends' houses. I'm like couch surfing. My family doesn't really want me there, but they feel stupid because their son is sleeping at other people's houses, and they're like, I guess we'll take them back. So even when I was home, it just didn't really feel like home. I'm struggling with like suicidal thoughts and depression. And all I know to do is just drink some more. That's all I can comprehend. I'm just like, you know, I'm just going to keep doing this. And like I said before, I went far down that like party rabbit hole. And so high school ends. I don't have much of a plan. I tried to go to Monco. I was living out of my 1988 Toyota Corolla that I bought off my grandmom. Love that car. Great on gas. I forgot to put the oil cap back on when I changed it. I'm coming back from Bloomsbury and it seized up on me. You know, that was my life. I was trying to take like computer programming or something at Monco, computer science. And like my first assignment was like, hey, we're going to buy a computer. You're going to disassemble it. You're going to document it. Then you're going to put it back together and you're going to document that. And I was like, I'm living out of my 88 Corolla. Any way I can do something else? And she's like, this isn't going to work for you. You should drop out. And I was like, cool. All right, we can do that. And I just went in the party. Living this way wasn't long before like consequences started to occur. So I had, I had a couple DUIs that happened, like, fortunately for me, right? Like, this is an alcoholic mind. I got one DUI, and before I went to court for that one, I got another one, so they merged them together, right? Anybody else know? Yeah, maybe. So they merged them together, right? I didn't get hit for a double, but if I get another one, it's my third, so I gotta be careful now, right? So, that happened for me, and I remember, I'm talking to them like, man, like I wasn't drinking, like it wasn't like what they, you know, I'm trying to justify it and minimalize everything that occurred, and they put me on probation, and probation is not fond of the lifestyle that I was living, so as a result of that, it was inevitable that I was going to continuously be locked up. So I had a lot of that in my story, going to jail, pretty much for hot urines every single time. Eventually it got to the point where I was like, how can I not go to jail? Right, so I played that game, and I'm thinking to myself, like, how can I get out of this? And I remember I would, like, meet my PO, and, like, always switch. Montgomery County would always switch. I was like, Montgomery County, Philadelphia, Bucks, Delco. And they would always switch my PO, and then, like, you get hit at this one, and then they bounce you to all these other ones. Like, you got to do the runaround, you know? So I would go, and then they'd be, like, a new PO. And it got to the point where I was just brutally honest because I didn't know what else to do. And I was like, look, this is what you're dealing with. I'm going to give you a hot urine. I don't know what to do about it. And that's it. You know, and one of the POs was like, hey, why don't you like try going to a rehab? And I remember the first time I went to a rehab, like my family was like, I was like, this is it. They're going to teach me like how to be a successful like drinker or something. You know, like I didn't know being sober or not drinking was not something that ever crossed my mind. It just did not make sense to me. So like when people would suggest it, I literally felt like an alien on a foreign planet because I was just like, they have no idea like that that's not going to happen. It just didn't seem like a reality for me. And I remember I went to rehab, my family's like ready to party because they've desperately been watching me. Like in the interim period, I'm not going to go into too much detail, but I had like suicide attempts and stuff like that. And they're like, you know, like, Eric's gonna die, like, hopefully he'll just stop, you know, maybe he'll go to a rehab. So like, when I went to a rehab, it was like a huge, I'm like, oh, this is it. And, I think I got kicked out in less than like 36 hours. I think it was like less than a day. It was really bad. And they were looking at me. I packed like everything I owned. It was weird. It was Valley Forge, Medical Center and Hospital. I took like an insane amount of clothes. I had a DVD player, like a portable DVD player, all these DVDs. Like, people don't have that much stuff in their apartments, I guarantee it. And they let me walk in with it, and then I got kicked out less than a week. They're like, what are you doing? I'm home. I thought you guys were going to tell me how to live, you know? They're like, no, you have to go. So that was my experience with rehab, my first experience with rehab. And it was kind of this like, cycle. So eventually I became just flat-out homeless as a result of the life that I was living in. And you know, it's like, okay, I get out of rehab, someone's dumb enough to let me live with them, I start experiencing unmanageability as a result of drinking. Furthermore, if I'm sober, this is another aspect of unmanageability I didn't touch on yet. It's like I can be dead sober and my life is unmanageable. I'm restless, irritable, discontent, and without power against the first one, I'm off to the races. That obsession of the mind is gonna kick into my brain, and it's just gonna start spinning and spinning and spinning and spinning and spinning until I get there. You know, and that's what it looked like. I was like trying to live with this person. I'm homeless. It's a very, very, very chaotic lifestyle. And I'm sure most people have had an experience with those things. As time unfolds, I realize that I can avoid jail by going to rehab. So like, it's like, okay, I'm going back to rehab this time. And then eventually I stayed for like 30 days. And my experience was like, okay, this was like a degree of a higher power for me. Right? It's like, I need to go to a detox. And then they suggested a rehab. I remember the first time I did rehab, I'm like, I should be good now. We did 30 days and it's like, I can go live life. The reality was, when that door shut behind me, fear kicked in to a tremendous degree, and I was without power against the first one because that was as far as my mind had opened up to allowing any kind of higher power into my life. It was pretty much, I will concede to this detox, I will concede to this 30 days that you guys are practically forcing me to do, plus my PO might not lock me up. And that was it. Anything outside of that, like a line of thinking, a program of action, a fellowship, listening to what someone suggested to me, was completely out the window. It was like, I'm going to take this 30 days of knowledge, and I'm going to run with it, and we're going to be good. My experience was that I was not good at all. Insert a few ICU visits, ER, car crashes, more of the same drama. And I'm homeless on my mom's back porch, and that's not like where I was stationed. I happened to be sleeping on my mom's back porch. The helper who helps my mom's husband's son, went to let the cat out and found me bundled up in some beach towels. My mom was not happy at all. She said, "You're gonna wait here and I'm gonna take you to rehab again." I said, "Okay." So, I went to this rehab, and like I said, I'm kind of just gonna push through this stuff and get to the solution-based stuff. But my life was extremely chaotic. Jails, institutions, and death, dead on. There was nothing else in the equation. A little bit of homelessness, whatever. And, so I went into Eagleville Rehab, and mind you, this is probably like my pushing 25 visits into a rehab at this point in time. And I go there and I'm playing spades and detox like any good alcoholic would do. And I meet this guy, Justin, and we were in small group after we were playing spades. And then I shared about how I didn't have anywhere to go. And he said, "Why don't you go to this?" He's like, "You should go to a recovery house." So now it's like, okay, like detox, rehab. So I was like, these slow, like people like pulling me in. I'm scratching the walls with my nails. Like, okay, like just go here. Here's the next step. And he's like, "You should go to this recovery house." I said, "What is that?" He said, "It's a place where you can go if like you're trying to like be sober." And I was like, "Will they let me in?" And he's like, yeah, call this number." And I called this guy. The program was Life's Journey out in Levittown. I was so nervous. I was like, "I hope they accept me." I didn't know in Levittown, you're pretty much it. And I remember I was like obsessively looking like, so I'll throw this in the equation, right? So like something that I do when I get sober, it's like I'm in jail, I'm sober, right? I'm in rehab and I'm sober. And I immediately exert my self-will into the equation to like an all-time high. I'm sober again. I can't mess this up. I gotta figure this out. I'm doing crossword puzzles and push-ups in the morning in jail, in rehab. Like my mind is just on overdrive because I can't mess up again. Self-will run riot. Like that is my story to a T. I'm trying to figure everything out and calculate everyone's behavioral patterns and what I'm gonna do, like everything. So here I am, I'm getting some suggestions and the walls are falling by the wayside. I'm starting to open up to these ideas. He's like, "Yo, you should call this guy." And I'm obsessed, like, "I gotta shave." And the nurses are like, "Dude, it's a phone interview." I'm like, "I need my best shirt, I need an iron." I feel like it's a phone interview to like a house in Levittown. And the guy's like, yeah, you can get a job. I'm like, "Yeah." He's like, "All right, cool, you're in, yeah, we'll pick you up." I'm like, "All right, what the heck?" So I went down there, which was cool, right? And it's like, okay, so I found out that like jail, a judge sitting there like, "Hey, you should not do this. It's not going to work for me, right? No human power could have relieved my alcoholism." Losing girlfriends, family crying, almost dying, waking up with tubes. And, it's like, it wasn't enough, right? And so I have these stages of higher powers in my life. And now I'm going to this recovery house, right? So I'm open-minded to this. I'm like, all right, let's see what they have to offer. And I was completely, I still had old ideas and concepts and preconceived ideas and notions about the world, the people in it, everything, recovery, women, jobs, money. Like, there was no inventory and there was no broadening my perception as a result of sitting down with someone who's spiritually grounded and doing a fist step and them saying, "Hey, did you ever look at it like this, Eric?" And then taking that to God and being like, "Oh, this is the truth. These are the facts about who I am as a person." Looking at myself was the last thing I ever wanted to do. And I don't even know if it's that I wanted to. It's just like, how could it be me? I got to figure the world out. I just exist. I remember a therapist being like, "So how are you doing today?" And I would talk for like 30 minutes. My mind, right? Like I would just go, "Bah, bah, bah." And then they'd be like, "So how are you doing?" I'm like, "I just told you everything." They're like, "Eric, you just told us everything about the world and literally not a single thing about yourself." I had a couple of counselors do that to me. I was like, "Oh, you're not listening. I need a new counselor. This is crazy, you know." So I get out to Levittown and I have these old ideas and stuff like that. And it's pretty much like, I'm in meetings, I'm looking for like, first of all, I'm joking with my friends because like that's what I know. I know sports, I know joking, talking trash with the guys, we're bidding, and then like looking for cute girls in the meeting, and then obsessing over work. I gotta get more money, I gotta pay off this debt, I'm on probation, I need to pay my fines and costs, I need to get a car, I need to get my license back, like that's just go. That's all I could really think about. And that got me by for maybe a couple of months. More trips to the ICU, more trips to the ER. And you know, what happened for me was this, right? Fast forward through that experience is that I'm in and out of hospitals. I'm in and out of jail. Some of the people, so this is what happened. I subjected myself to a house that said, hey, look, in order to live here, you have to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm like, cool, I'll go to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'll get this sheet signed. That's gonna solve everything, right? If I just get these signatures, we'll be good to go. They're going to let me live here. My life is going to be good. Probably get married any day now. And so I'm doing that, and I have these setbacks, right, like these perceived failures in my life. And really, like, what's happening for me is I'm reaching an internal bottom. I have a lot of external bottoms, but I'm getting closer and closer and closer to this internal bottom where all of my ideas and thoughts and my plans are running to an end, right? So I noticed that some of the people that I met and that I had like this like relation to, right? I was like, no, you know what? Out in this Levittown place, like some of these guys are kind of crazy like me, like they know the same spots, they drink the same way, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, maybe I'm not like that alone. You know, like there's other degenerates. It was like being on, Rudolph, like Misfit Island, with like the Jack in the Box and stuff. I was like, oh, I made it. Like, that was like college to me. I was like, we're all here, you know. And what happened as time progressed on is that like some of those people, their lives were getting better. And it wasn't because they like figured it out. It's because they adapted a new way of life. And it stuck out to me. I wasn't completely sold on it, but I was like, there's something going on here because that guy's nuts and I don't know why he's doing good, but whatever. Right? And I couldn't comprehend a spiritual way of life or anything like that, but that's what was happening and I took note of it. Time progressed on further and further, and I ended up being in a recovery house and I'm going to this meeting, and it's like, okay, so I'm just attending meetings, right? Meeting makers make it. Debatable. It's good to be at meetings. It's better to find people who have adapted and found a new way of life and who have had an experience with the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and who can walk side by side with you into freedom. So I'm going to this one meeting. I'm at a recovery house. Like, you got to go to this meeting. I'm like, cool, no problem. And I bump into a friend of mine, a guy that I grew up with. He was one of the guys that my mom, my parents were like, you should not hang out with this kid. He's bad news. He's one of the people that definitely would have been at the spot drinking or doing other things, burning couches. That was one of the activities that we did for whatever weird reason. And he was one of those guys, the bad kids, the tougher kids in my neighborhood that I was like not supposed to hang out with. And I hadn't seen him for probably like 8 years, right? And my thought process when I see him at the end of the meeting and he's smiling, walking up to me, and I'm smiling, walking up to him. And literally what I thought to myself is he's on probation too. They got him, you know, and I'm laughing. I'm thinking like, this is funny, man. They're mandating us to come here. He must be in a house too. Like, ha ha ha. Like thinking like it's a joke. And I walk up to him and say, yo, man, what are you doing here? And he goes, I know what I'm doing here. What are you doing here? I don't know. This house is making me come here, you know? And I was like, I looked at him, I could see he was so at peace. They talk about like the twinkle in the eye, right? Like that like weird look, like when people just seem so at peace. And like he had that. It was really unusual for me to say that around, like, about this kid, because like, this is one of the kids, and I'm like, we're tough kids in the neighborhood. You know, like, I didn't want to, like, but, like, I was like, yo, this guy looks like, he's got a twinkle in his eye, for real. Like, he looks at peace. And I said, you know, how long have you been doing this? He's like, oh, like, eight or nine years. And I was like, willingly? And he is like, yeah, man. He's like, you know, this is what I do. This is my lifestyle now. And I never forgot that I had a second step experience, right? I knew that there was something going on in his life that was working for him. I knew that it wasn't him. I knew that he didn't just adapt this new line of thinking or like self-will something into existence. I could see that he was happy, joyous, and free, and he had contented sobriety. I knew he wasn't high on drugs. I knew he wasn't drinking, and I knew that he had contented sobriety. And I never forgot that. Time went on for me. I didn't like jump into this lifestyle. I still wasn't sold on it, and I ended up humbled back into Eagleville rehab. And I knew his number by off the top of my head. And I called him and I was like, yo, man, I'm in rehab again. He's like, yeah, I know, your family called me, you know? And I was like, yeah, you think you could like help me do whatever you're doing when I get, you know, I was like middle school dance, like, you know, like, will you be my Valentine? And I just was like, yo, man, do you think you could like help me when I get out of here? He's like, yep, here's what you're going to do. You're going to go to this recovery house. And when you get out, call me and we'll get together. I went to Connect the Dots in Norristown, and immediately within, by the end of the week, I was doing step work. I had a home group, I had a commitment, and I was going to RCIA in Devon and helping him chair a meeting and bring a message in. So we were like finding people and having them bring me in. He just launched me right into it. We would sit in meetings and like the basket would come around, he'd be like, yo, and hand me a dollar, like, this goes in the basket. And he'd be like, don't go to a meeting and not put a dollar in the basket. Like, put, like, you know, and like he also gave me a job. He was one of those guys, like, hey, look, I'll also give you a job. Like, very, very fortunate that he was in a position to do that for me. But someone did it for him. He'd be like, yo, like, you know that money I pay you? Like, put this money in the basket. Like, little things like that. But he launched me into this way of life. He got me involved in a church. Now, mind you, my mom, you know, one of the loving, tolerant, patient people in my life, who has dealt with me, I've caused significant harm in my mother's life. She has encouraged church, Christian-based, there's a Christian-based rehab in New Jersey. She's like, you're gonna go here, I'll pay for it, I'll fuck it. You know, she was pushing that on me, but I was in this position where I was like, you know what, like, I know Chuck is crazy the way I'm crazy, and I'm gonna listen to him. And like, I went in, and like, I just opened up my mind to all of these things, and I had a very profound experience, and I felt significant freedom in my life. What did not happen was this. I was not diligent in my relationship with God the way that I should have been. I wasn't approaching God every morning on my knees from a position of humility, right? And I became powerless over the first one. I woke up one day, and I was gone, right? Cunning, baffling, and powerful. And the reality is, I never built like a true relationship with God. It was like a fairly selfish relationship, but I also just wasn't really pushing myself. I was kind of just like, yeah, me and God are cool. But I wasn't practicing anything that would put me in a deeper level of humility and really trying to expand on that relationship. I think I had like 16 or 17 months sober at the time, and I relapsed, and like immediately I lost it all, and I'm sitting there living out of my 2011 Honda CRZ. I'm not sure if anyone here is familiar with that car. It's a two-seater Honda hybrid. And it's like got bucket seats. It was not comfortable to live out of. And I was insane. I had resentments, right? I had unchecked resentments. My 10th step was weak. My 11th step was weak. I was of service to the people around me, like I was trying to carry a message of hope and recovery, but I didn't fully understand and comprehend what it was that I suffered from. And as a result of that, I didn't have humility. And as a result of a lack of humility, I wasn't willing to hit my knees in the morning. I wasn't willing to seek God in resentments. I wasn't willing to seek God in fears. And thankfully, there are people carrying a message of hope and recovery. So when I came back around, they were in a position to be of maximum service to God, and to open my eyes up to some things and to give me hope when I didn't have any hope at all. So what happened is, it's actually a funny story. There's a clubhouse in Lansdale called Expect a Miracle. I'm living out of my car. I'm in Weiss Markets pretending to be an employee on a smoke break. I was there for like 9 hours. And, you know, someone reached out to me. They knew I was struggling. They're like, hey, man, what's up? Like, where are you at? How are you doing? I was like, I'm doing horrible. I'm absolutely starving. I'm living out of my car. And, you know, I'm miserable. And they're like, you know, Expect a Miracle always has food and coffee. Like, why don't you go there? I was like, absolutely not. So I'm filled with resentment. I'm filled with bitterness. And I don't want anything to do with AA. I don't want anything to do with people in AA. I literally don't want anything to do with it. And I'm extremely embarrassed and ashamed. Extremely. It's very difficult for me to think to myself, like, oh, yeah, let me go walk around those people again. Like, that's just how I felt. But I thought, you know, I put all those seven traditions in, and like, I deserve a hot cup of coffee from Expect a Miracle right now. And someone might be dumb enough to give me some money. And I'm just being brutally honest about where I was at and things. And so that was my baseline. Like, and I went there, and it was like a 7 in the morning meeting. I forget what time they meet over there in the morning. And I walked in, and no offense, but it was all old-timers who were armed with the facts about themselves. They knew what it was to be an alcoholic. They knew I was trying to play everyone in the room by putting on the, oh, you know, I'm homeless, I'm an alcoholic, and everything like that. And they just calmly stood there, and they were like, make the nooner, kid. And I was like, oh, my gosh, just give me $20, please. And That's all they said. They let me get my coffee and a very, very powerful experience in my life. So everyone leaves and I'm sitting there in my car and I have brand new shoes in the back and, you know, and I was like, man, someone's got to buy these shoes. And I couldn't go anywhere. I didn't have any gas. And, there was a guy, that waited. Everyone else left and the guy waited and there was a light rain and I remember I'm praying. I'm just like, God, please help me. Cause I already knew what it was. And, there's just one of those like foxhole prayers. I'm like, man, just, please God, like I already know what this looks like. Just anything, just something. And, I didn't realize the one guy, he stood there and, he knocks on my window and he's like, put your window down. He had two bags of, food. It was like sliced apples and like some other food. And he looks at me and he just goes, make the new year. And he walked back to his truck and, crushed me. I started crying and I sat there in my car and, that was one alcoholic being able to look at another alcoholic and go to right to where and go right to the place that they were in. I have a deep appreciation for that experience and I try to be in that position to meet alcoholics where they're at. I don't care if you have 25 years sobriety. If I think you look like you're going to kill yourself, I'm going to try to have a conversation with you. If I think you're going to go drink again, I'm going to try to have a conversation with you. If you're brand new and you're struggling, I'm going to try to meet you right where you're at. And I don't think I'm any better than anybody. As a result of this program, the hierarchy has dissipated. When I initially got here, it was like, this person's here, this person's there, da, da, da. We're all alcoholics looking to figure out a new way of life, you know, to practice a new way of life. And we're all here to support and encourage each other to do that. And that's the only thing that matters in these rooms. It's that simple for me. That was a really cool experience. And it did move me to make the new. Still begrudgingly, but I was like, I'll make the new. I also was thinking like, I'll make the noon so that I can tell those guys, like, I made your noon and nothing happened. I went to the noon and I walked in. The room was absolutely packed. I scanned the room, can't know anybody. I don't want anyone to see me. Then I'm back in here. I saw one guy. He locked eyes with me, immediately went to his phone. I was like, ah, here we go. You know, he's like, he's back. We got him. Pull the net. And I was like, whatever. So the meeting's going on, and that same guy actually knocked over an energy drink that he had in front of him. I'll never forget the sound. It sounded like a cartoon. It was like, woo, 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 woo. And he knocked over this can, and I'm like, oh, my gosh. And I knew that meant he was going to go walk by me to get napkin or paper towels or something. And he walks by me. He's like, yo, what's up, Eric? How you doing, man? I'm like, I'm great. You know, I'm like shivering in a basketball jersey or something weird. And he's like, why don't we go out after the meeting? I'll get you something to eat, and I'll throw you a couple bucks. Smartest thing he could have said. I'll throw you a couple bucks. That's all I heard. And, he wasn't like trying to deceive me. He was being genuine. He was like, yo, I'll give you something to eat, like $30. Like, what do you need, man? And, he called up, Ron K, who is my current sponsor. Should have mentioned this earlier. Ron K is my sponsor. He knows he's my sponsor. I keep in touch with him. He's not just some guy that I put on a paper, give my PO. I'm off probation, by the way. And I'm off meds. I'm off probation. Happy, joyous, and free. Contented sobriety. No triggers. And, he calls Ron K. And, you know, the two of them, they meet, you know, we all go to American Star Diner and they're like, hey, look, we can get you into rehab today. I'm like, look, this is moving a little too fast for me. And my response to them was, I still have things. And, Ron starts cracking up laughing. He's like, that's the most alcoholic thing I ever heard. And he knew what it meant. He knew that it meant like I still had there's still a little bit left. And I said, hey, look, I'll go tomorrow. I said, I got the Intoxiloc in my car. I'm going to park my car on the side of my mother's house because that's what moms are for. Just kidding. Significant harm to my mom. I love my mom very much, and I will be making amends to her for the rest of my life, and a lot of other people. But I was like, yeah, I'll park my car on the side of my mom's house. I got the Intoxiloc. I don't want it to expire, yada, yada, yada. And they're like, all right, cool. We're going thrift store shopping. And I love thrift store shopping. I didn't have any money. I had a car with new shoes in it. So what happened is I made some phone calls to get into rehab, to look into some things, and I did what I had to do that day, and the next day I parked my car on the side of my mom's house. I went out to White Deer from Lancaster, and actually, you know what, real cool story, Ron actually, before they left the diner, Ron's like, hey, you want any of these AA CDs? I was like, oh my gosh, dude, get away from me. Like, I don't want an AA CD. What do you mean, do I want an AA CD? Like, I just need the pain to stop. Like, that's what I'm thinking in my head. Ron's a very nice guy and a great salesman. And I was like, you know what, I will take some of these CDs. And he came up and he's so happy and stuff like that. And we had a good time. And I have a deep appreciation for that experience. And he's like, you want these AA CDs? I'm like, sure. They're like, what do you got? And he starts reading names, and he says, Ante. And Ante is a buddy of mine that Chuck, Charles Neilman, Charles Chuck, introduced me to when I was in sobriety with him. And I love Ante. He's awesome. He's from Croatia. Hilarious character. And I was like, you know what? I'll take Ante's. And I listened to Ante's when I was driving to do what I had to do. And he spoke about having a period of sobriety and relapsing. And he also talked about going out to Lancaster and meeting his wife. So I'm thinking, you know, the rehab I got into was right there on Lancaster. A part of me is still a little off. And I'm like, we might meet our wife out there. We were 20 minutes away. My mom nudges me. She's like, we're 20 minutes away. Do you want to stop at Walmart for deodorant and bath soap or something? I'm like, whatever, you know. And I remember I looked at it in my phone. It was an all-men's facility. I'm like, come on. You know, it was like that last bit of humility, like getting pulled out of me. Before I went to White Deer Run, Ron made a suggestion. He said, hey, why don't you, he's like, you know the third step prayer? I was like, yeah. He's like, why don't you wake up every morning, go to your knees and say the third step prayer? I was like, all right, cool. He's like, call me as much as possible. And when you get out, we're going to be doing this. He's like, I'm doing this. We're doing this out here. When you get out, call me. We'll plug you right in. We'll get things going for you. I finished treatment at White Deer Run, Lancaster, and you know, something that I told myself when I came back around, I was like, Eric, you've never given this a fair chance. You've never truly tried to build a relationship with God, and you've never actually tried to listen to these people and give this program a fair chance. When I want to do something, when I'm trying to go in a direction, I'm very focused, high energy, like, let's go, let's get it. I never gave Alcoholics Anonymous, this way of life, that chance. I never gave God that chance. The concept, the idea of God, higher power, however you would like me to word that, that's not going to rub you the wrong way. You know, something that I knew about this, I was like, you know, Eric, like you got to give this a fair chance. So I got out of rehab and went to suddenly the Spirit House, which I was blacklisted from as a result of numerous relapses. Fortunately, they had let me go back in there, and I was extremely grateful for that opportunity to go into the recovery house. I knew that rehab was not going to be sufficient as far as long-term sobriety, happy, joyous, and free, contented sobriety was concerned. I knew that a recovery house was not going to do it for me. I knew that just going to meetings and just floating here and just hanging out was not going to do it for me. So it's like, okay, detox, rehab, recovery house, meeting, fellowship, and then they're like, hey, Eric, why don't you get a sponsor and build a relationship with God? I'm like, how? They're like, here you go, buddy, 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was like, oh, okay, cool. And Ron immediately got me into the step work. We got into 1, 2, and 3, first step, second step, and third step concepts, and I wrote down my 4-step. I was diligent about it. For me personally, it was important that I allocate time in my day to do that, because otherwise I'm like, oh, I'll do it. And, you know, I'm a busy-minded person in early sobriety. So I put it on my schedule. Like, there were, like, blocks of time. I was like, you're going to sit here for 3 hours. You're going to do this. You're going to do this. And I got through it. We met at American Star Diner. We did my 5th step. I had really cool experiences. One of the things that I was resentful about was that my father was murdered. And I was sitting there and I'm talking to Ron about this and I'm like, hey man, like, you know, I just really hate that whole street where he was killed, and just like, I don't know, it just bothers me. Like, I just want to go up there and fight somebody. And he's like, you know, he's like, do you hear the selfishness in your statement? And I was like, no, like, what are you talking about? Like, what do you mean selfish in my statement? Like, how am I being selfish here? And he's like, well, how many people get killed in a day, like on earth? And I was like, oh, probably a lot. And he's like, why aren't you upset when they get killed? And I was like, well, I mean, I don't know. Like, they're not my dad. He's like, do you hear the selfishness in your statement? And I was like, no, what do you mean? He's like, who would you just say? I was like, my dad. He's like, your dad. He's like, let's, like, zoom out from the world and look at the world from the moon or something. He's like, how significant are we in the scheme of things? I was like, not really significant. He's like, how big are we? I was like, oh, smaller than a speck of sand. And he's like, you know, it's selfish to look at this. Like, it's my dad. He's like, you're trapped in that, like that line of thinking, that selfishness. And it made sense what he said. And I was able to, so another thing that I was able to practice this time around was like listening to people and actually like having a conversation and then taking it to God. That's a really important part of my recovery this time around, is like, if I talk to someone, sponsees, human beings, anyone, sponsor, and like we're having a conversation, when I've done that conversation, I try to find God in that. Because I can sit here and talk to you guys about this and that, and I suffered from this, and I had that experience, but only God and I know to what degree those things are actually true within me. So I started to do that. Gosh, I really wish I had more time to talk, sorry. And, you know, and that was a really cool experience for me because I was able to see the selfishness in that. And I took that practice, I started to practice that in all of my resentments. So when I'm at work and I'm like, my boss, and my pay that I get, I started to see the selfishness in all of those things. And it helped me see, in a loving way, the insignificance of my life. It doesn't mean that I'm like this, oh, I'm useless, you know, like, woe is me. But, like, I'm a person who's, like, hyper-analytical, and I'll be, like, overemphasize my own importance and my own perceptions and understandings about the world and the people related to me. And that was a really cool experience for me. We got through the fifth step. I took time. I went home. I meditated, getting to six, seven, prayer. Not everything disappeared overnight. It was important for me to do inventory, 10-step, 11-step concepts. I'm trying to think of what I can do here in 7 minutes. Sorry, guys. I'm gonna have to lump all this into some stuff here. So I get into the steps. Another thing that I'll mention, right? I learned when I got here initially, like the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous was this burdensome to-do list. It was just so tedious. I'm like, I can't wait to get this done so I can just be, I'm done. I did the 12 steps. Like, give me my 12-step coin. Let me take it with me into the sunset. And AA and everything about this in general, like, to be brutally honest, was not attractive to me. If you're anything like me, like, my default mind was not, like, thinking, like, oh, let me figure out a spiritual way of life. I learned that this was, I learned to look at this as a way of life, which it lightened the load as far as the steps were concerned for me. I started to incorporate the 12 steps into my lifestyle. Instead of looking at it like I have to do it perfect, because like I would do like this, I would try to do every step perfect, and I was hyper-analytical and over-critical of myself, and then it would just put me into this like obsessive state of mind of self-reliance. And the more I started to look at it as a lifestyle that people are just living, so like I come to Alcoholics Anonymous and people have this lifestyle, it really lightened it for me. Another crucial thing for me was. Ron told me, he's like, hey, like, well, you got a suit and tie? Like, I'll get you a suit and tie. He rides around with suit and ties for the most part. And my initial home group was actually a Conscious Contact speaker group in Doylestown. They meet Saturday night at 8:30 at St. Paul's Lutheran Church. I think it is something like that. St. Paul's on Main Street, 301 North Main Street, I think it is. Don't quote me on that. You show up at the wrong address and use the AA meeting guide app or whatever. I don't know. And I showed up there, and like I said before, like I used to pick my fellowship. I would show up, and like, where are the guys that play sports and talk trash and da da da. And I learned discipline, and there were people that were showing up there every week, and that became my fellowship. It was the people that were willing to wake up on a daily basis and pursue this lifestyle. And as a result of that, like this wasn't like my fellowship today was not a fellowship that like I handpicked. It was just other people who were showing up, willing to pursue this life. And trying to build a relationship with God and through practice of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and service to others. And that was a really cool experience for me because it did for me what I couldn't do for myself. Just by being diligent and showing up to a home group and going through with that commitment, I had that experience of like building a fellowship that I didn't hand pick. And I have tremendous respect for a lot of those people, and those are some of the people that I reach out to. To just talk to things, we encourage each other, we have fun with this. I have 4 minutes. Ah, man. I'm sorry. It's so yeah, man. I mean, I'm a large believer in putting in the work before I need to. And let me just touch on some of this stuff that like happened for me as a result of this. When I used to be sober before, like I said, like I was extremely self-reliant, like self-will run riot, and I would try to like figure everything out and get money and get a girlfriend and things like that. This time around, I made a decision, like I'm going to build a relationship with God, and that has been and is the most important thing in my life, and still it will be that way. You know, like that's what I go for on a daily basis. That's like the most important thing to me in my life. As a result of putting God at the center of everything that I've done in my life, my work life has flourished. First of all, Let's start with this. So we get better spiritually, we get better mentally, we get better physically. Like I said before, I was kind of joking, but I'm dead serious. Like, I no longer suffer from depression. I don't want to kill myself. I no longer suffer from the obsession to drink or do anything else. I'm clear thinking, for the most part, in my thoughts and ideas and in my mind. I'm typically pretty darn at peace in my day. And as a result of that, I'm able to go into the physical, tangible world and rebuild some of my relationships with people like my family. I bring that into my morning meditation, some of the living amends that I have. I still wake up to this day. I do a third step prayer. And I am diligent about seeking God in things like resentments, fear, selfishness. Am I able to be of service to other people? And so that transformed my line of thinking, which has allowed me to flourish in other areas of my life. So I'm married today. I have identical twin boys, which is great. Work life is very good. But a really cool thing that happened for me, right? It's like I have like that other stuff that I always chased. But like still to this day, I have this beautiful relationship with God and this peace within my soul. I also have the ability to sit here with you guys and to sit down with guys one-on-one and share an experience of strength and hope with them, right? Understanding what it is to be an alcoholic and to have those moments where it's like the guy that handed me the food in the window and be able to go there with people. And that took, so like, I don't know if anyone else had the experience of getting sober and not knowing what to do with all the baggage and the wreckage of the past. Today, that's like my greatest asset. And that's our primary purpose, stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. Like, God took all of that dark, burdensome stuff and gave it a purpose. And the more that I utilize that to carry out God's will, the more it heals my soul. I'll end with this. There's a line in the big book, and it says, they believe in themselves, but even more in the power that pulls chronic alcoholics back from the gates of death. And I believe that everybody in this room and everybody in Alcoholics Anonymous in general has, we're all uniquely equipped to carry a message of hope and recovery and to sit down with another alcoholic and to have that heart-to-heart with them. And that's a beautiful thing, and that all of us have that tool within us. My family, my friends, and my loved ones would have done anything to sit down and have a heart-to-heart conversation and to move me in the right direction. And we're all equipped with that. And even more so than that, God is working. God is alive and well. And I believe in that with all of my heart and soul. That's why I show up here. I have no idea, but my story, you know, I was rambling on a little bit. I'm sleep deprived and stuff. But, you know, like hopefully there's like a message of hope and recovery in there, and it's like that's all well and good, but more than that, God is working in these rooms, and that's undeniable to me. That's why I show up to Alcoholics Anonymous. If I did not believe that, I would not have come out here tonight. So I'm here to let you know that God is alive and well. Thank you.